Okay. Any other questions for Brian?
Good job, Brian.
Oh, Terry.
I'm sorry. I've been sitting here thinking about what Keisha said about getting word out about these services, and I just think, well, of course, with the regional centers, the regional centers will know, and the service coordinators know what resources they have available to them. But actually, problems don't start with them. It starts at home with families. I'm sure there's more than, or providers in their residences, and there must be more than one who, because of prior experiences, have hesitated to call for assistance because they think it would either mean, particularly a family, the police show up or other things, or they end up in an IMD. I'm certainly letting people know that there are other options now and other therapies, therapeutic interventions that can be maybe extremely important. And this is work that people should be, or resources people should be, you know, proud of and really cheer. So absolutely, the word has to get out.
Agreed. Okay, so good lead in to the safety net. Now, we've talked about most of it, but let me go ahead. Oh, I'm so sorry. We're not leading to that. Brian still has to talk about disparity.
I still want to talk. I'll be brief, I promise. So in fiscal year 16-17 through ABX21, we received $11 million to address disparity statewide, and the department issued guidelines to regional centers. And regional centers were required to meet with their local communities on proposals that they would put forth to the department. We received those proposals from regional centers, and subsequently, through looking at the data that we received from regional centers regarding the public meetings that they held, as well as the department going out and holding statewide stakeholder meetings with regards to disparities within the community system, we considered all of the proposals, and in the end were able to approve 96 different proposals amongst the 21 regional centers. Regional centers also received funding in 16-17 to hire a cultural specialist, and the department also has received funding for a position. So we've been holding regular calls with the regional center cultural specialist to maintain communication with regards to their implementation of the various proposals. And there's really some broad categories that have come out of both the stakeholder process as well as the regional center's proposals. And some of those broad categories are the implementation of Promotora or Navigator programs to reach communities that haven't traditionally been met. Translation of materials into various languages to help families to better understand the service system and the services that are available through regional centers. Translation equipment, regional centers have requested funding for that, as well as funding for case management positions that are smaller and more specialized to meet the needs of individuals who maybe receive regional center case management services but don't necessarily avail themselves of funding from the regional center. They reach out to understand why there is a lack of initiative there for those families. Some of the proposals, through some of the proposals, regional centers are working with a whole variety of community-based organizations and have entered into contracts with those organizations. And the proposals are in full swing at this point. We were able to approve almost up to the $11 million that we had available to us. So we are continuing to track the progress of both qualitative and quantitative measures through regional centers on the impact that the proposals are having. And we also have $11 million in fiscal year 17-18 that's available to us. And we're developing guidelines through the Director's Disparity Advisory Group. We are developing those guidelines to get those out to regional centers. There is new legislation that opens the proposals up to both regional centers and community-based organizations in the current year. So the guidelines will go out to both regional centers and stakeholders so that we can obtain proposals through both entities. We also, in legislation, there was the lifting of the cap on respite that goes into effect on January 1, 2018. And at the most recent Director's Disparity Advisory Group, we talked about this and how do we inform the community that this change is going to occur. And so the department is working on correspondence that will go out to regional centers, as well as sort of an overall plan of how we get the word out to consumers and families and stakeholders and providers, and that communication will be provided in a variety of different languages so that we can make sure that everyone is well aware of this change in statute. So that's kind of an update on disparity. Any questions? Yes, Keisha.
Hello. Keisha Waller, State Council on Veterans with Disabilities. What is a Navigator program?
A Navigator program is having a facilitator that is not affiliated with the regional center to come alongside, if you will, or to make a connection with families to help them to, quote-unquote, navigate their service system. So helping them to understand what services might be available to them through generic resources, what services are available through the regional center, maybe helping them to apply for benefits. So it's really sort of like a hands-on local assistance for families.
Is it available for is it only available for families, or is it also available for regional center individuals like self-advocates as well?
It's for regional center consumers and families to help them access the system.
How does someone access the Navigator program?
Through the regional center that is implementing the proposal. So on the department's website, we've posted all of the approved proposals, and we also have a consolidated list of which regional centers are implementing that program. And so regional centers are looking at which individuals and which communities need additional assistance to access their services.
Can the department send the task force a link to that?
We absolutely can, yes.
Thank you.
Carlos Flores, San Diego Regional Center. Brian. It happened last time. My voice. I got a bat. So, Brian, a question and a statement. Question is, are there similarities between a Navigator program and a Promotora program? Are they similar?
Yes.
Okay. And the statement is, in the current environment, we're seeing issues where families from Muslim communities and Latino communities are extremely fearful, and they are not availing themselves of regional center services because they are in fear. I'm saying that as an example of some really complicated issues out there in the community relative to serving people from different ethnicities and cultures and languages, and I'm hoping at some point in the future we have a plan to get at what these differences are, these disparities. Why are there differences? Why are there disparities? What are the root issues here that are causing them? You know, is it lack of information? What is it? So right now, I appreciate all the money that's being spent, but in some ways it feels like we're throwing darts at a dartboard without getting at the real issues here that we're dealing with in the community. So hopefully that's in the pipeline.
Catherine? So I agree with Carlos about the current issues relative to the immigration discussion at the federal level. We just did a training for our staff yesterday that was provided by one of the immigration legal centers that talked about the work they're doing. And, you know, we're thinking through how we partner with groups that have the expertise that we might not have to educate families about that. So to me, a component of as we do outreach to communities has to shift always to talk about the issues that are really important to the community and use, you know, sort of cultural and other brokers that have, you know, the credibility with those communities that people trust. There's very good materials out there about sort of family safety plans and what needs to be put in place for, you know, individuals who might be concerned about their immigration status. There's obviously good information about issues of public charge, which is what I think people are fearful of with regional center service, which is probably not applicable to them. So it may be one of those opportunities for ARCA and DRC to collaborate about putting together some materials that relate specifically to this community. My understanding was that ARCA had done that or done some of that already, but we were really happy, Katie Hornberger and I, to meet with any of you and to talk about how we address what really is alarming and I think appropriately alarming to people from communities about their sort of status and not wanting to harm their status of, you know, committing a crime by accepting a benefit or something else and then finding out that that puts them at jeopardy of a quicker path to deportation. So anyway, happy to work on that with anyone here who's interested.
No, please go ahead.
Is that where you were going with that, Carlos? Were you thinking about immigration issues when you made that statement? Because my brain went someplace different.
I use that as one example of various issues that exist in the community that may be causing those disparities and differences.
Okay. Because another, I'm not going to call it a problem or a difficulty, maybe it's a challenge, is that, of course, there are very culture-bound attitudes and perceptions regarding disabilities. And many cultures have their own way of caring for a person with a disability. This is kind of a research interest of mine, so you kind of sparked a spark in me. So when we are talking about delivering our services to a diverse population, we have to walk a fine line between being there in a supportive way without telling people kind of what's wrong with their culture and how we can make it better. So it's just fraught with those kinds of issues as well.
You got it. Thank you.
Very complex issue. And it's an important one that we have a lot of priority on as a department, and we're continuing to work on it. And I think, Catherine, I think we have a meeting scheduled already. If not, I'll get it on the calendar for ARCA and DRC and the department so we can schedule something. So any additional questions or anything else that you want? Are you done talking yet, Brian? Don't worry, the battery on the mic will go off in a minute.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just Carlos.
Right. Yeah, but that only works for Carlos. Okay. So we can always revisit any questions, but just some additional information regarding the safety net and providing an update. You know, as we can tell, it's a we have so many important topics and we have so much that we're working on and having to continue to make sure that we're staying connected with the input because it's all evolving. But one of the important things that had occurred through the work of the DS Task Force and then also doing some support work also within the stakeholder meetings that we had throughout the state helped inform us on the safety net plan that was released in May. So it, Christine, you had mentioned also the meeting in Fresno. Having the input and the work that was done with the DS Task Force and then going around the state and having the smaller meetings where we had clinicians, we had consumers and family members and regional centers, and you take a look at the, I've said it, but I'm so impressed by the level of involvement that we had throughout the state and the discussion, the healthy discussion that happened to say, here's the barriers, here are the challenges, here's what's working, let's try to replicate some things, and then bringing that together. And while the safety net plan is a stepping stone, it is really where we're taking a look at how we can enhance what we're currently having, and then also take a look at, let's try some additional areas and see how we do with implementing those. So I just want to give you a real quick update. In the back of your handouts, you do have a chart that was used to also inform you through the budget process that summarizes each of the activities in the plan concepts that were presented. So you can reference that. It also then breaks down, as John had shared, the $7.5 million that was a general fund and the $13.7 million that was existing funds that includes community placement plan, and then also the Harbor Village account that will help support the homes for renovation that's over on Mark Lane and at Fairview, and showing then reflecting the $21.2 million. But I do want to give you an update. You know, while there hasn't been a lot of time since it was released, but we have had certainly some activities in moving it forward and some ideas. Additionally, part of Assembly Bill 107, there's additional language not only within the concepts, but also as we do continue to develop. And when we take a look at the enhanced behavioral supports homes, we also are always reevaluating, and there are some additional guidance and requirements that we have as we take a look at for clients' rights and protections. And so as a department, as we're reviewing the enhanced behavioral supports homes, we take a look at the program, the plan of operation. As a department, we need to review and approve those plans of operations before it goes to Department of Social Services for licensing. But within that, to have assurances that we're getting a glimpse and taking a look at and approving what is going to be used as far as any physical restraints and what are the protections to make sure that the approach that's being used is really a positive behavioral support. And it's really about a person-centered planning process. So making sure that we're working with a plan of operation that embraces that, that's consistent with that. So we are... we do have to do the review. We're also going to be providing guidance, and as approved in recent statute, a guidelines is going to be released by December of 2017. That's going to be the guide that's going to be used as we're reviewing the plans of operations. AB 107 also strengthens some of the client's rights protections with community crisis homes, and then also with the mental health rehabilitation centers, the MHRCs, and notification when there's admissions. And so we'll make sure that we provide guidance regarding what's outlined in statute when that letter of guidance goes out to the regional centers. I'm excited to report that when we took a look at the safety net plan and how we're going to be rolling out the safety net and developing it, there's a lot of elements to it. When you take a look at across the board, so we're expanding the STAR homes up in Northern California. We're going to have two community homes. One of them is going to be the transition from the existing home on the Sonoma property that's going to be going to the community home, and then 1819 will be developing another home. Then in Southern California, we're developing the Mark Lane homes, and one of those is going to be for the individuals that are currently at Fairview or the services that are offered at Fairview and the Southern Star. And we're developing homes to support individuals transitioning from the secured treatment program. And those homes are going to be in Central California. It will be vendor operated. It is going to be provided through an RFP process with a regional center yet to be defined, and we're working on that. Additionally, we're going to have intensive support services that are going to be supporting individuals transitioning from the secured treatment program out of Porterville, where they may go to one of the step-down transition homes, or they may be going to another setting. And again, the guidance and the guidelines regarding the transition supports will also be moving forward, and we're working on those guidelines as well. We're developing then also the homes that we reference as far as individuals that are moving from the IMDs. So we'll have an option if an individual is not going into, say, a supported living or another residential setting, if there is a need to help support somebody who is in an IMD into an intense, like a community crisis home, we have the four homes that we're going to be developing. Mobile crisis, we talk about the mobile crisis. It's going to be state operated. And it's going to be operated out of the STAR services in Northern California, STAR services in Southern California. And the initial piece to the benefit of what we're going to be able to do with this STAR mobile services is to immediately start what's called the 4418 assessment. because that allows then for every person who is in crisis, and it is not to replace the mobile crisis teams that are state operated, not to replace what is existing currently within each of the regional center catchment areas. Many and most of the regional centers have existing support services, whether it's through the county or they have crisis services that they already have within their own vendors within their community. This is really then an added supplement or support that is beyond that. And, you know, we realize that we're not going to be able to meet every single need in every single geographic area, but this is a point in time in which we're going to be able to start. We can make sure that we can really start that intensive support and make sure that we have the 4418 process that we can review and then work with the teams to say, what are the supports that are going to be able to help support that person that is in crisis? As we move forward with all of these services, Brian can't do it all. We need to be able to have a team that is going to be able to help guide and support us as we're moving forward in the development. So currently we have identified two positions, and pleased to say that we have one that's accepted to be going into the position at headquarters on an acting. So we have Dr. Brad Backstrom, who is going to be the acting supervising senior psychologist that is going to be responsible for all statewide STAR services. So he'll be working on developing the additional services that are going to be expanded in Northern California and Southern California, and then also responsible for developing the model for the mobile services in Northern and Southern. Those of you who do know Dr. Backstrom will know that he is just a remarkable professional and is very focused on making sure that individuals have supports from a very positive place and from a very person-centered place. He's been responsible for Northern California STAR services for a number of years and was instrumental in getting that started. So we're really pleased that he's accepted coming on immediately in an acting position to say, let's go ahead and start thinking through the real important areas and work on laying this out and how we move forward. We're also able to add a safety net manager in the director's office at headquarters. And very pleased, Dr. Leanne Christian, who is currently working at Regional Center of Orange County, is a director of clinical services, has been instrumental in working on the national core indicators for many years. She also has a BCBA. She's somebody who is extremely passionate. If you've had a chance to talk with her, person-centered planning and thinking is utmost of a priority for Dr. Christian. We're very pleased to have both of them. So Leanne, Dr. Christian is going to be leading our safety net kind of development and kind of guiding as we go through, like I just said, all of the different areas. We need to make sure that we're developing a very good roadmap to make sure that we're developing within the time frames that we need to develop. We're being thoughtful. They're not out there by themselves, but they are the two that are identified as the leads and will continue to develop, you know, the teams and identify the folks that are going to be doing this. I do want to say, though, that one of the important parts of where we're going forward are it's going to be critical that we continue to have stakeholder engagement. So we will be reaching out. We are going to be making sure that we're having the discussions, getting the input, having the guidance as we move forward. Part of that is that I'm going to be meeting and part of the team at the department will be meeting with each of the regional centers in Northern California that have individuals at Sonoma that are transitioning. And we're going to be meeting with the families and the regional center within that catchment area to walk through the safety net so we can get additional questions answered, because it's certainly an area of concern of theirs. So questions, of course. So Keisha, then Connie. Then a break.
Thank you. Keisha Butler, St. Catherine, the Women's Disabilities. Number one, what is the 4418 assessment?
So that's a reference to the WNI code that has an assessment for anybody who may need to go to the STAR services, the acute crisis services. So it's a comprehensive whole person assessment as far as making sure then looking at what are the needs of the individual. Can the developmental center or the STAR services specifically, can they safely and effectively support the individual? What are those needs? And then if not, then what are the supports and services that are needed to safely support them in their living option? Dwayne, anything else on that? Okay. Carlos?
Specifically on 4418. But correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that the 4418 process is used for prior to entry into a developmental center?
It's for the STAR services. And Dwayne can...
For the developmental center, but that's because the crisis services
are... I understand.
You're going to need a mic. Sorry, Dwayne.
So Dwayne said it's for developmental centers, but you're applying it to the STAR because it's on developmental center grounds.
Well, it is... Part of,
the next part of my question
sure.
is, it's my understanding that the STAR services will in the future be off developmental center grounds, so they're no longer developmental centers. So will we require a 4418 process? And the reason I ask that is because it can be cumbersome when you're talking about an emergency that needs to be dealt with immediately. Perhaps we can discuss a different process.
We can always discuss it.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's where on the mobile it allows to start the process to actually shorten what is occurring that you're experiencing. So, yeah, we can definitely discuss it. And Connie, and then did you want to break or go through the question?
Finish.
Okay. Connie?
Keisha, we think so much alike. I didn't know what that was either. And I appreciate the discussion because I'd like to get a copy of it, what it looks like. And if it is cumbersome, and then we all talked about streamlining, that would be really, really important. I applaud you every time I hear person-centered plan, and planning is critical, and especially, not only for people with severe challenges, but for especially used in that parameter. So I love it, and I need to say every time I say a person-centered plan, it should impact the IPP, but I see those as separate processes. The second is, where do we fit psychiatric concerns in this? Because I raised this in the beginning about over-medication, and I just feel we have to have that as part. The people you described, I can't wait to talk to and meet, but that is one of the factors. These people are on so many pieces of medication that we don't even know who they are. And then the timelines for the mobile acute crisis teams, I'm a stickler. I know, Jim, I'm waiting for you. But I'm a stickler for having an idea, even if it's wrong. I mean, you're not going to start out wrong, but I understand in government. Well, I don't understand, but I'm a volunteer. I don't work in government. What are they?
So for the mobile crisis, we're looking at the end of this calendar year is what we're looking at as far as the resources being available. And we'll be able to give updates as we go along. So Brad's working on the development plan right now. Right. Keisha?
Yes, my question is that are the mobile crisis teams statewide, are they going to be vendorized?
So the two state-operated mobile crisis teams with STAR are in the north and the south. And reality is that they're going to be centered primarily in a geographic area in which they're going to be able to get to fairly quickly. That said, if there's a need and it can be coordinated for somebody to go to Fresno, we're going to have our team so they'll be able to do that. Now, it's important to know, though, that we do have a lot of mobile crisis teams within regional centers that are already vendored. We have some existing ones that really, taking a look at, may even be a model for replication. They're very strong. We're going to see that some geographic areas are going to have a less dependency on the state acute mobile crisis teams because within their local community, they're pretty rich in those resources.
How many statewide? So you only have two teams?
We, as a state operated, only have two teams, But within the regional centers, I don't have, but I can get for you how many mobile crisis teams we have in the state that are also vendored by the regional center.
That'd be fantastic. Thank you.
We'll get that for you, Keisha. Terry?
Yes. Is Dr. Backstrom from Sonoma Developmental Center?
That's correct.
Okay. So then this is actually transporting the developmental center expertise into the community setting. So that's really nice. Will Dr. Christian stay at Regional Center of Orange County and operate out of there, or how does that
No, work? She's actually going to be at headquarters here in Sacramento.
I see. Okay. And I did actually meet with her this week at a person-centered planning meeting at Fairview, and I think this is really super to have them there.
I should clarify, she'll be starting with us at the end of August.
Okay. Thank you.
Connie?
No, I'm done.
Okay. Chris?
We need a microphone.
Question is, how many will be on the team, on the crisis team that you guys have?
So, Duane, I think we have projected 14 total right now statewide, so 7 and 7. Full-time equivalents is what we're looking at. So, and we're going to continue to evaluate it as it's being implemented.
So they'll be on call 24/7.
So there's going to be availability. They're not all going to be on call 24/7, all 14, but there will be an available person that can kind of troubleshoot the issue 24 hours a day.
Okay. What's the reaction time for that? Do they have?
It's a great question, but it's not fully defined. It all depends. If the reaction time is depending on the geographic, the issue, and, you know, we're going to have to work through each of those areas as we move forward. Those are the questions that we're going to have to continue to answer.
Great. Thank you. As I said at the outset, we're going to hold from the self-determination. You'll be here, Connie. After our lunch break, we'll try to limit the lunch break to about 30 minutes so that we can get through the agenda. But as I said at the outset, I want to give a moment for anyone who needs to have a public comment to do so now, and then we'll have another public comment at the close of the meeting, and then we'll take a lunch break. So, Jim, if there's anyone there in the public that wants to make a comment.
Hi, Yvonne Soto with DDSO and Person-Centered Advocacy Partnership. I just wanted to touch on the HCBS transition funds. We're excited and grateful to have received some transition funding. In theory, we haven't received it yet. But I would like to request that the department maybe clarify with the regional centers the possibility of releasing startup funds so that we can begin to initiate our outside-the-box thinking to implement the transitions that we wish to do, which was what we requested. We're unable to do anything until we have the funds to hire the staff in which to do that. And I think it's just important to reinforce that the whole purpose of this is to provide fluidity and flexibility for services based on individual person-centered needs, and to treat this as a program service design concept kind of puts things back in the box. So I just would like to make that awareness, and I think there may be other people receiving transition funds that this may be an issue.
Thanks, Yvonne.
Hi, I'm Mario Alvarez with EBSH, Frontier in the West. I'd like to thank the department for, behalf of my four individuals that are currently placed at EBSH. I'd like to thank the department for developing that model so that they can live in a less restrictive environment and not in the Del Momos anymore. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else before we break for lunch? Okay, we will, it's just almost 12 o'clock. We will reconvene at 12:30, and if there's anyone left on the phone line, you can disconnect and call back in at 12:30. Thanks, everyone. Well, it is now 12:30, and we do have an ambitious agenda. I must say that when I looked at the agenda and saw this long list of updates, I thought, oh, well, we'll roll through this pretty quickly. But there is so, this is so rich with information and engagement that I'm delighted. So we're going to pick up where we left off with the department completing the updates, and then we'll go to the work group and the review of the draft report. And our goal will still to be out before 3 if possible, but certainly by 3. We have a hard stop at 3 o'clock. So with that, Nancy, I will let you pick up again. And then can you check and see if anybody rejoined on the phone? Is there a way to know that?
I'm here. This is Kathy.
Oh, good. Thanks, Kathy. I should have thought of that myself. So, okay, we're good. All right. Well, thanks.
No worries.
All right, we're starting.
Okay, so we have Jim Knight that's going to finish the updates. The first one being the self-determination and then HCBS waiver.
Hi. Thanks, Nancy. And, oh, there's still some power left after Brian was here. Good. So first update on self-determination, a couple of things. One that we always want to know is where's the application, the federal application that we need to get approved for federal funding before we can start. So as we talked about before, we've whittled down the number of issues with the federal government CMS to just a small number. All of the responses to the remaining questions that we have at this point, with the exception of one, which I'll go over here in a second, are now with the Department of Healthcare Services. And the one issue that we have left is more of a technical issue about the interaction of waiver services and services that are available through Medi-Cal. So just as at a high level, the waiver rules do not allow services to be provided under the waiver if they're available under Medi-Cal. So we have a call with CMS set up with CMS and Department of Healthcare Services on Friday to review that. And then very shortly thereafter, we anticipate then being able to get that full informal package back to CMS so that they can then give us their informal responses. When I say full package, meaning all of the answers that we have outstanding at this point, as well as the draft waiver application. Timing of that, as far as when we'll hear back from CMS, again, is somewhat undetermined, but with the very small number of questions that we have outstanding, we anticipate a fairly quick turnaround. So we'll keep folks up to date on that. The other thing that's coming up that we're working on is some training for regional centers, and then also for what we'll, and I'll go into in a bit, we'll call it train the trainer. So the self-determination law required the department to provide training to regional centers on some of the nuts and bolts, if you will, of self-determination. And so with the help of our advisory group, we had already developed some of those informational materials for regional centers. So we're going to start that in, we're targeting mid to late next month to start on that. And we're going to, not only are we going to have regional centers participate, but we're also going to invite members of the local volunteer advisory committees, and also have some consumers and families hopefully help provide the training with the regional centers as well. So we're targeting to do 5 different ones of those throughout the state. And we should have that finalized here very soon. One of the things that we need to finalize first is the second part of that training. So with the advisory group and knowing that the first 3 years that self-determination was limited to 2,500 people, the folks wanted to make sure that those 2,500 people, at least the ones that were going to be considered, at least had some idea of what self-determination was before they, quote, got on the list. So DDS is going to do that selection of that first 2,500 people, do it randomly. So the concept was that people, in order to get on the list, if you will, would need to participate in a informational meeting. And then those that got that high-level information on what self-determination was, their names would be forwarded to the department, so then we could then use that to choose people who would then ultimately be part of that first 2,500. So the people that are going to be able to do those informational meetings or pre-enrollment informational meetings are going to be regional centers and other community-based organizations. But we wanted to make sure that the information that was presented was consistent. So what we just sent out last week to our advisory group was a draft of what that training is going to be. Wanted some comments, so we're regrouping tomorrow to get feedback on that, so that hopefully then we can finalize it and then lock in the dates for the training as well. Because not only do we need to finalize that, we need to make sure that it's translated into multiple languages and make sure we can get plenty of notice out to people that they're aware of the training that's coming out. So that's at a high level where we're at, and I'm sure that someone has questions. I'm not looking at you at all, Connie.
So this is my voodoo doll. She has a cape, and she's very happy.
Oh, good. Okay.
No, I need medication. Speaking about psychiatric medication. No, I just, I'm glad that it's at this point. I know that if I ask you for timelines, you know, you said soon. I think there's this movie, I think, where, with the stone, what's it, Romancing the Stone, where somebody says, Ira, when are you coming back? And he says, soon. And that's like, I feel like so much is soon, but... do you feel that question? I mean, that I understand the question that you said between Medi-Cal services and then the waiver services is not a big complicated question that's going to take more time to resolve with the feds?
I don't believe so. We've had a couple of discussions with them already, so this should just be finalizing what their expectations are of us and what we described. So,
So right now you're just saying it's going to be soon, but
well,
your call is Friday, and then it goes to Health and Human Services, and then...
Healthcare Services, yeah.
Sorry. And then...
And then on to CMS. So Healthcare Services understands the pressure and the I don't know if pressure is the right word, but certainly the desire that is from all of you all and us. That's why we haven't held back any information with them, so this will just be the final piece so that we can get it to CMS as quickly as possible, and that's what we can commit to doing.
Did you feel your last call with CMS was productive? Because I know I didn't get a chance to talk to you to see how that went.
Yes.
I mean, yes, they...
Yeah, yes, in that we got a direction in which we thought we needed to go, and so that's why we've worked with Healthcare Services, and so we're going to present that to them on Friday. And the reason we want to do that and present it to them over the phone as opposed to throwing it all together in the draft is so that we can hopefully prevent any questions after we send it to them as part of the whole package. So both CMS and Healthcare Services have been very responsive in working with us and providing that technical assistance. So we've made a significant amount of progress. I know it's been delayed, but we really are down to just a few.
I know. So I know I'm being a kind of a brat, but this is like 2014. We had this conference 2015. We had updated information. So I know you know how badly we want it. And I want to thank you for including the families and the consumers as part of the training. Because I think what I've learned over the years waiting with really good people, I know if you were king or queen or you had all that power, it would have happened. But essentially what families are saying to me, consumers are saying to me, the bottom line is who's in charge. And I've learned over time waiting that that's the key question.
Must be a play on his last name. If he was a king or a queen. Either
knight. You're a knight. That's a problem. Yeah. You're a knight. You got to be higher up.
But you gave me a wand.
I hope you still have it.
Keisha and then Will.
Good afternoon. Keisha, Mother of State Council on Developmental Disabilities. My questions are, I've got two, matter of fact. My first question is that how is the department or the regional centers or whatever authority is going to, how are you guys going to share the information that there's a training out there for all the consumers and all the families to know about it?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So the training that we're going to be doing and is really going to be geared towards the regional centers and then also some community-based organizations. So it's going to be a train the trainer. So it'll be those folks then that will go forward and doing the actual meetings about the enrollment meetings and the like. However, we are going to, as soon as we get the dates locked down, through the regional centers, our work group and the others, start spreading the word about that the trainings are going to happen and those that want to be trained, the trainers can participate in those as well.
So it's going to be a trained trainer. So that means that people who go through the training will be able to train other clients and other people in self-determination.
Right. So it will be just more giving kind of a high-level overview of what self-determination is. So to give people, there are some folks who may not really understand even the basics of what self-determination is, and so. With our work group, wanted to make sure that folks did. So they knew that there was, yes, some different things that could be done with self-determination, more responsibility, but also with that responsibility came some extra workload that if someone wanted to do a self-determination. So we wanted to, at a high level, let people know what that is about. And so then that train the trainer will be that those folks can then go and talk with families and consumers who are interested, you're right, to give that high-level information about what self-determination is.
Great. And my other question is how are the 2,500 people going to be selected? Is it going to be like a lottery system?
Yeah, pretty much. So it'll be, there's once all those folks who have went through the those informational meetings, their names get sent to us, to the department. And then we've already, and we can send that out to you as well, kind of mapped out those 2,500 people based on geography. So it's proportional by the regional center size. So the regional centers that have more folks that they're serving now would have more folks that would be available to enroll in self-determination. And then within that regional center, it's going to be representative based on people's age, gender, disability, and the like, too. So the department's going to do that overall draw of those, that lottery, but making sure that it's representative of the state.
Yeah, representative of all the statewide people.
Right.
Per regional center.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then Catherine and Will, I know I skipped you, but I actually skipped
okay.
Catherine
Maybe we have
first.
The same questions, who knows. So when you submit the packet to the feds, is that on or off the clock?
It'll be off the clock, so it'd still be informal at this point.
Okay, and then what's the timeline for getting it on the clock, which is what in the end actually matters?
Right, so it'll be dependent on what follow-up questions we get from that submission.
But are you expecting questions again?
I would expect some follow-up, but with the small number that have left, I wouldn't expect very many.
Okay, and then the second question is, so you described the challenges with you can't provide a service on the waiver if it's also in the state plan. That's actually no different than what happens in the traditional regional center service. I mean, the behavioral health services is maybe the most recent example of that. So what are the services that are, is it the same services that are questioned like behavioral health, or is it something else, or how are you working through this since, anyway?
Yeah, it's just and it's coming up as part of our renewal and the other waiver as well. So, I mean, you're right, they're the same rules that we have. So, you know, as part of self-determination, we had proposed to provide nursing services, speech therapy, other types of things, as well as what we call specialized therapeutic services. And so really just clarifying with CMS, what are the differences in those and kind of when the Medi-Cal or state plan stops and when the waiver would pick up.
Okay. So I guess we look forward to the answers to those, because I think it's kind of that interesting, then how do you put your plan together when,
right,
which will, I mean, it's kind of the same problem that exists in the current system.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
We were close. That was actually one of my questions. The second one was really that I'm assuming that when we, there'll be real clear direction from the department to regional centers and others, that on the train the trainers, you want that to be as broad scope as possible to make sure they're picking up as many folks from different cultures and people who are going to access the broadest number of communities that we can to make sure we educate folks would be a part of that outreach.
Right. And that, I mean, I think that's another benefit of the department kind of collecting all the names so that we can see on a statewide basis, are we really getting a good pool from the different areas and the different representations?
One more question. How do the regional centers know this is going to be happening? I know that there was some discussion of informing them, but there still seems to be out there with some that this isn't going to happen for a while. And so if we're going to start those trainings next month and it's summertime and some people are away, I'm just concerned that maybe it would be great to have a letter from the department to ARCA or to make sure that every regional center is informed that the trainings are actually happening.
Yeah, and we have had discussions with ARCA and the regional center directors and other ARCA groups so that they know that this is being in plan, that we're in planning of that, and also we're working through the regional centers to finalize the actual locations too. So it's once those are done, then we'll have the formalized letter out.
So every regional center knows this is happening, would you say?
Well, say that people at every regional center are aware. Is everyone at every regional center aware? I don't know that.
No, I don't mean everyone at every regional center. No, I mean a regional center, or somebody at each regional center knows this is happening.
Would you agree with that question? Yes. Yes.
Cross your heart, hope to die.
Else on that? Okay. And then next is about the home and community-based services waiver. So talk about a few things in that. One is the transition plan. So that's with the settings requirements. That was from CMS, the deadline was 2019, but recently was extended to 2022. So we've been working along with Department of Healthcare Services and another of other departments in working through the statewide transition plan that we've talked about before, which is an outline of, from the statewide, not just DDS's perspective, the different activities that we need to do in order to move towards meeting those requirements, and also an assessment of where we are as a state. And by assessment of that, meaning how do our laws and regulations line up with what the federal requirements are. So, and I think it was in March or April, I believe, that we, and I'll get the exact date, that we received feedback on the latest version of that transition plan from CMS. And they have asked for more specificity in a few areas, and just at a high level, they want more information on how we determined our laws either do or do not meet the requirements, more specificity on what we're going to do when those laws don't meet the requirements, and also more specifics on what we're going to do with individual providers or settings, as they refer to it, if there are changes that need to be made. So, again, we're working with healthcare services on and the other departments in developing a response so we can resubmit that transition plan. Some DDS-specific activities that are going along with this. There was funding in last year's budget, and there is continuing funding this year, $15 million that we've talked about before for providers that could apply for a portion of that money if they needed to make some changes or modifications to move towards meeting the requirements. Yvonne, who's not here any longer, made reference to that. We did work through all the, what we did was we had developed a concept process where providers had to briefly describe an idea of what they would do with the funding, so it wasn't a full-blown proposal. Came to the department, we reviewed those. ultimately selected 108, I believe, concepts that we selected for initial approval at various regional centers. And then the regional centers have then worked with the providers then to get full proposals and enter into contracts to implement those their proposals over the next 3 years. So the next round, so for this year, we had an initial meeting with a subgroup of this advisor group to look at some ways that we can improve what we've done, learned from last year. One of the things that we've certainly all agreed to and wanted to do is make sure that we gave more of a framework for how people can go about in developing those concepts. Last year, intentionally, we wanted to leave it open. We did not want to put folks in a box and say, this is what you should do, or these are some of the ideas. We wanted to see if we could have some out-of-the-box thinking that was brought up, and so we didn't want to limit those thought processes. So in some ways, I think that worked out very well. But we also learned, and we knew this, but we wanted to get an idea, is that we needed to, in some way, though, kind of guide that process in to a certain extent. So things that we had talked about and with our work group is making sure that there is documentation in this of consultation with the people that you provide services for and their families. So what input has gone into that? How the person-centered service planning is going to take into account whatever changes or whatever concept is being put forward. These types of things that we're going to make sure that those are part of the responses that come back to us. That's also going to help us to be able to evaluate what went through or what providers went through in developing these concepts. So we should have that draft after our initial call we had a couple weeks ago out here next week, so that we can then regroup and get that the input from our advisory group, so that we're targeting the first 2 weeks, in August to get those finalized out so we can start getting concepts being submitted again. Additionally, you know, one of the, this obviously applies to self-determination and also for these new settings rules, the big kind of at the centerpiece of it is person-centered service planning. I know we've had some work that we've done with our work group, but we also need to, since this is such a big issue and very important, we're consulting with the National Association of Developmental State Developmental Disabilities Directors. Don't make me say the acronym. It's Sandra. Yes, it is. It's just, people always misinterpret it. So because, like I said, this is a big issue. So I think it's within the next 2 weeks we're going to, they're going to be on site working with the state, but then also how then we can incorporate in the future some strategies for working with regional centers and other stakeholders in what we need to do to move forward. There's a lot of things that are going on in different locations on person-centered planning. We want to try and coordinate that as much as possible, and also making sure that we have a broad understanding, not only for the state, but also how we get that across to everyone. Because that's going to be a big piece, you know, going back to the funding for the concept proposals, that it was pretty clear that we really need to make sure that person-centered process is used even in developing those from the provider perspective as well.
Can you give a quick update on the survey?
Oh, yes, the survey. So as part of the, we've mentioned a couple times, ABX21, there was a significant amount of funding available to provide rate increases for most, but not all, service providers, regional center service providers, and that was targeted in a couple of ways. One, for to increase wages and or benefits for direct service staff, and also a bit for, to increase or to give a, cover some extra administrative expenses for providers. One of the requirements of that was that providers had to submit a survey or respond to a survey on how that funding was used. So we developed a draft survey, and then yesterday, at roughly 6 o'clock?
6:05.
To be exact. We were able to get that out, the final version of that. And one of the things that, you know, is really what we hope is going to make this very helpful and much more successful is that, as opposed to some other surveys that we've done that have been more paper-based or individually file-based, this is web-based. It's all the information is going to come in one area. It'll be much from the providers and other folks who have tested it so far and found that it's been very easy or much easier to do than others. In fact, I think we're talking to some providers when you log in as a provider now, because there's a lot of information that's already filled out based on what the regional center has, you're already 36% done. That's pretty good. Yeah. So, and there are webinars that are set up for providers. There's going to be one this Thursday, and then there's a schedule for the coming weeks that they'll be available then as well. There's going to be a recorded version of that too, in case it's not, you know, that you're not able to participate in one of those. But you don't have to participate in one of those. There's been a lot of activity even before 9 o'clock today with people that have already actually gone in and completed them. So we're really hopeful that with all the input that we've had from you all and others, that we've tried to make it as understandable as possible and fairly straightforward, where there's a number of check boxes, just kind of how you use the money. So kind of at a high level, that's where we're at. There is a help desk available from the agency that developed the web-based, they call it a portal, that can help folks to move through and register for that survey. And then also the department and regional centers are available for questions as well. So, and we are more than happy to participate. I've already reached out to a number of organizations offering, if you want to have some small group discussions, any questions, anything that we can do to help out with that. We'll work with regional centers, vendor advisory committees, whomever, if that would be of assistance to folks in helping that we can make sure that we can get this done for folks by October 1. Any questions on that, Keisha, and then Connie?
Yes, Keisha, whether state tax on development disabilities. What are the federal guidelines for the ACBS waiver requirements? Federal requirements.
Are you talking about the new federal rule? And
the new federal rule, yeah.
Yeah, so at a high level, they want to make sure that services are provided in a way that ensures that people have opportunities to be a part of and interact with the community, and they're not restrictive in preventing of that. So that there's obviously some things that more details that go up beyond that, but want to make sure that if services are, quote, community-based, that they are not delivered as if they were in an isolated setting that's more like a lack of a better term, or from CMS's perspective, an institution.
So it's like the Olmstead decision. It's like taking away people from the DCs and moving them out to the community. It's like focusing everything back into the community, right? People into the community and taking away from institutions?
Well, this is, I mean, certainly there's a lot of parallels between, you know, the Olmstead plan and what these rules are. You know, from the federal government's perspective, that they made funding that's set aside to provide services in the community. And so they wanted to put some parameters on what community looked like. So that's really what these rules are about. And so they do line up a lot with what the priorities are within the Olmstead as well.
I thought so. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Connie?
I'm just curious, with the change of administration and the extension of the deadline over the country, do you see a movement of just dropping back and slowing it down, or is it the same impetus? I think you said, 22 states are now had their original transition plan approved?
2022 was the year that it got extended to. I don't have the number that I've had their plans approved at this point. But I don't know what other states are doing. We're still moving forward because even though we got the extension, there's still a lot of work to do.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Sure. Will?
Will Sutherland. Three questions. So on the concepts, one of the things I think we talked about in the work group was putting out some sort of general its guidelines, or at least what was types of things were awarded in areas to help people sort of focus in on that. And as I've said frequently in other venues, is to make sure that people are linking where you're not meeting the rule, why you should get the funding. A lot of people said, I'm good on all these things, and then submit a proposal, and it's like, okay, you missed the point, is you have to be fixing something. So, you know, something pretty basic would be on that one. And then in moving forward, obviously the biggest part of the ACBS settings effort is going to be self-assessment for vendors. So where are we sort of on finalizing that self-assessment? I've seen, I know it's varying things, I just don't know how close we are to actually having something we're going to run with.
Yeah, so the, and that's another reminder I had the other thing to mention too. So the self-assessment, what folks are working on right now is really kind of the collection of it, because much like we talked about the surveys for the rate increase, kind of managing that is going to be something that's not only for regional centers but for us. So that's the assessment itself pretty much done, but we want to be able to manage it.
Okay.
The other thing that we'll be working on here very shortly too, that's going to go along not with the self-assessment, but when we go out and do a sample of visits, is working through it's going to be a discussion or a survey, is what's been called, with the folks who receive services. So we're going to be pulling together a group of some stakeholders too to work on developing that, because that's, again, if you talk about, if it's supposed to be about people's experiences, we need to get the input from the people that are receiving services. So.
And then finally, I think, I mean, everybody in this room should be realize the charge that on the ABX 2.1 funding, every vendor you know, you should be telling multiple times, because everybody has to do it. Everybody. And then the other ones on the outreach is making sure that we really push it out into its multiple language and multiple channels, and using the navigators and the promontories. I mean, those folks to really get out, because I think the same issue that Carlos raised related to reticence to submit information or about that could be the same issue that we face in getting the surveys back, and then it impacts the system because those rates would then go down as of October 1st. So I think the more that everybody knows that this is a huge issue, and everybody in the next 10 weeks should be making sure that people are on top of that issue would be helpful.
Definitely.
Most providers, not every provider.
Right.
Good to go. Carlos, you're going to give us an update on the regional center operations work.
Maybe I should give a little background on the core staff formula. So the core staff formula has two purposes. It's used for budgeting, and it's used for the allocation of monies to the regional centers for their operations. It's important to emphasize that it's never been a staffing pattern instrument. It's not how regional centers are required to staff. It's a methodology to get us at a pot of money so that we can make decisions at the regional center on how to use the money to staff properly. The core staff formula was developed around 1979, that long ago, when regional centers were a lot smaller than they are today and technology was not what it is today. And when it was first developed, it was based on, and this mic is working wonderfully well. When it was first developed, it was based on comparable state staff salaries and benefits. And the process was to be that on an occasional basis, it would be updated as state staffs and state benefits were updated. The last time the core staff formula was updated was 1991. So the salaries that are associated with the core staff formula are 1991 salaries. Since that time, it's also receive some revisions in terms of the type of staff in the formula, but it's also received revisions in terms of unallocated reductions. So since 1980s, there have been several unallocated reductions totaling to $44 million. So we think it's time for a revision of the core staff formula, and we've made that recommendation here. And we were asked to, ARCA was asked to work with the Department of Developmental Services to come up with recommendations on the formula. This is a very, very complicated process. So ARCA has been working for a while now to develop our recommendations. And we recently met with department staff, DDS staff, to go through our recommendations and to discuss it. And after that, we met with some agency staff to discuss the recommendations. And we realized, we have been realizing, we've known it all along how complicated this is. So what we have today is a three-part recommendation on going forward with the revising the core staff formula. So the first thing we need to do, and for the benefit of everyone, is to analyze how regional centers are currently staffing, how much are they paying for that staff, and what their benefit packages are. What's reality today, not 1991? Once we've done that analysis, then we will go back to the core staff formula, use the bones of the core staff formula, but recreate it and rebase it based on current realities, what we're doing today with the dollars. Again, we emphasize, and there are concerns that in the regional center, of regional center directors, to be honest, that as we do this, we don't want to lose the flexibility that we have in staffing regional centers because for two reasons. Number one is because, as I said earlier, the regional center system is based on responding to local communities. That's why there are 21 regional centers. That's why our private nonprofits are to respond to local communities. Secondly is because the communities are different. And as we staff in those communities, we need to staff differently. If you are a very, very large regional center, you may need more than the chief counselors allocated in a core staff formula. That's just one example of many, many examples. So once we've rebased the core staff formula, brought up to reality, then the next important discussion is how do we develop a process or processes going forward that for budgeting and for allocation that take into account the future regional center needs? I think the cultural specialist is a good example of a position that was added to all regional centers. So as these needs come up, as things change, how do we take into consideration how to budget for those changes and then allocate to regional centers? And also, most importantly, is the growth. I think since forever, regional centers have been growing at about a 5% clip, and I think the projection for the current fiscal year is 330,000 or somewhere close to there, people that will be serving. Keep in mind that when this allocation methodology was created in 1978-79, the average at regional centers that we were serving was 2,000 people. So lots of changes since 1979, 78, and that's changed since 91 since it was last, the salaries were last adjusted. So we will be working closely, ARCA and the department, under these three principles to redesign the core staff formula and consider those future budgeting needs. Is that fair?
Great. Thanks. That was a good update, Carlos. Thanks very much. Okay. Chris. It's your turn.
All right. So as we turn to our last work group summary, I wanted to highlight it. It's part of the overall report, and for our convenience, it's the very last page. So our process has always been to bring back our work group summaries to this whole group for, you know, comment and sort of discussion. So I wanted to take a quick moment and give an opportunity just to look at this one summary before we dive into the full report and open up for any comments or thoughts that you want to have from the group on the housing document. And this, again, was the process we did with all the different work groups. We've met, I think, 3 times on this topic, looked at barriers, guiding principles, gaps, and then recommendations. And you can see the bolded recommendations there. For the sake of time, I won't read every single one, but I'd open up to the group if they have any comments, thoughts, edits, things we missed. So, yeah, it's the last page in the packet. And I'll apologize in advance. We were hoping to get these out a little earlier, but things, you know what they were, we got it out last night. So hopefully everyone had some time to review. And with that, I'll open up to any comments on the work group summary.